Hi, everybody. Once again, this is Thomas Stone of Terminal Economics. Yes, I am the webmaster of Terminal Economics. I have a graduate degree in economics. I've been studying economics since the mid-80s. Now it's a solid 40 years. Yes, it's been a long time. I'm getting old, I can assure you of this. Anyway, I digress. This podcast is in response to a gentleman, I'd assume it's a gentleman, who is a graduate business degree holder, and he has concerns regarding, I guess, the lies and the frauds that have been going on, and he's discovered, kind of unearthed the more of the esoteric understanding of what is going on. Obviously, he's insightful enough that this gentleman has had questions, observations. They don't seem to be making sense, right? The world as presented, especially him coming from a business background, the world is not making sense. And I would assume that probably 95% of the readers I have left and the listeners of my podcast I have left are in that camp. The other five are probably just monitoring me, which is why I get hack attempts and other stuff. Like I could check the bandwidth, and that 5% is like DOD and NSA type stuff. I digress. As long as we're talking the truth, right? And we're not saying anything that's lying, and we're not threatening people, which we aren't, then we're fine. We can say whatever we want. We're not threatening people. And the reason why, like, why would I threaten someone like President Trump? He's a figurehead. He's a puppet. He's a servant of that synagogue of Satan, right? The private banking cartel. Imagine if there were no private banking cartels running the shows, running these privately run central banks. Imagine the politicians. They would be like the founding fathers. Yes, the very people that the establishment media pillory and rail against. These are the people that are probably the most decent folk that could probably ever walk the halls of the Capitol Hill or the White House, right? I've often referred to Andrew Jackson, the person who is ripped apart as some sort of racist. Well, yeah, he closed down the second National Bank of the United States back in the 1830s. He threw out the bankers and he referred to them. He referred to the Gospels of Jesus. He called them a den of vipers and thieves. Well, there you go. Well, this gentleman, who's a business major, a graduate degree business major, I included the email. I got his approval to anonymize it and just show you the email. And I just wanted to go down a bunch of the things. He says he's a 2018 graduate business major. He discovered the rabbit hole, like many of us have discovered. The world didn't make sense to him. Here he is. He's a graduate business major, and the world's not making sense to him. And he said, it's macroeconomics, so his macroeconomics teacher asked the class of 500 who owns the Federal Reserve, and he answered the Treasury. Well, turns out it's not the Treasury. The Treasury is the servant to the lender, and the lender is the Federal Reserve. But it's funny, the macroeconomics teacher, I'm sure, probably told him it's owned by the member banks, right? Shareholders of the banks, and the banks own the Federal Reserve, and they're there to serve the country and the government at the behest of the U.S. Treasury. Well, we understand that the privately run central banks are not owned, they on the surface are owned by the banks, maybe the J.P. Morgans and the Goldman Sachs, but who owns those? And that's how this shell game persists. And people say, well, the Federal Reserve is the belly of the beast. And I say, well, perhaps you might be right, but all the privately run central banks are run the same way. They have different schemes of ownership. So the Federal Reserve might be owned by the banks like Truist Bank or J.P. Morgan Chase or Citigroup or Bank of America, right? They own the shares and they have controlling interests. And they say they're there to serve the U.S. government. So It's a very unique form of ownership, the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve was put into place back in 1913 through the Federal Reserve Act to run the United States. And I told you, the United States is a very important country. The secret societies, this private banking cartel, know exactly what the United States is, which is why the United States was the tip of the spear for World War I, World War II, why they were continually brought in to these global conflicts. And their military was used to subdue. So you could say, well, we lost the Vietnam War. Yeah, that's true. We did. But guess what? Because of the Vietnam War, because of all these wars, Korean War, we turned South Korea, we turned Southeast Asia, we turned communist China into manufacturing facilities for the New World Order manufacturing economy, right? And so without these wars that the United States military was used by the private for the private banking cartel's pleasure, we turned the whole world into the New World Order. All of the countries, virtually all of the countries, have been now developed and are part of the New World Order in one form or another. Even the Middle East. Look at all the Middle Eastern countries that are now part of the New World Order. India is now part of the New World Order. Jacob's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, use their military and their economic prowess and their global reserve currency and global transaction currency status to develop the New World Order. It is a one-world government. It comes from the belly of the beast, for better or for worse, and that's just the fact. And so they use the Federal Reserve. But what I'm trying to get at is all the privately run, all the central banks in one form or another are privately run. And you may say, well, Chris, Turkmenistan's central bank is owned by the government. And maybe on paper it is. But, and this is very important to understand, how does Turkmenistan raise its revenue? By going into the credit markets and borrowing from the banks, borrowing from the large institutions. So even on paper, even if a central bank is being run, say, technically by the government, so they go, oh, it's owned by the government, it's still borrowing in the private credit markets. It's not printing its money as it needs to. It's a lot different than it was back in the 1800s with the United States when they threw out the banks. They relied on bankers, but they also relied on the treasury and they relied on tax revenue and they spent within their means. They didn't run these big deficits. It's only as these central banks became privately owned and became beholden to this private banking cartel that really controls the entire world, well, then things started to change. The Bank of Russia, the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, even North Korea. These countries borrow in the private credit markets. They raise money through debt issuance, and they borrow. And they are beholden to their creditors. And who's going to lend to them? It's the private banking cartel. Now you may say, Chris, well, that's risky. They lose money. They take all this risk. Well, the problem is that these countries then become beholden to those creditors. The Bible is very clear on this, and this man is a Jesus man. He's made that clear. And you know why people become a Jesus person if you're a woman? But most of the people who I come across, they're men that dare to peel back these layers of the onion. It's because it's downright awful. It's to those who are untrained, all of this is such a spiritually euthanizing, demoralizing way of life that I find a lot of women can't get past it, and they get highly emotionally charged with it. But I noticed that I'd have to suspect, based on the emails I have and the people who get my emails and read, I would suspect that 80% of the people who stop by my blog are male. And I guess it's just male. It's geared to the male. It's geared to that type of mind, for better or for worse. In fact, I don't remember the last time I received an email from a woman. I don't mean to be chauvinist or misogynist. Hey, you know, call me whatever it is, but you know I'm a traditionalist, so it's all about beating down the male. So I think I get a lot of people who come by who are men, obviously. So understand that this system is a very devilish, stable system. So the Federal Reserve is not owned by the Treasury. The Federal Reserve is not owned by the government. The Federal Reserve is owned by the banks. What makes this different is that the Federal Reserve, the private banking cartel, chose to run the United States as that head. So it all trickles down from the United States. We already have a global currency, for instance. It's the U.S. dollar. And I told you about this conspiracy that goes back decades. It goes back a long way. And I told you in the past couple of blog posts about Pastor Lindsey Williams, for instance. Pastor Lindsey Williams was back in the 70s when they built out the Alaska pipeline. Pastor Lindsey Williams decided he wanted to become the pastor to the Alaska pipeline workers. And so he moved to Alaska. They said, okay, fine, if that's what you want to do, we'll give you a room, a stipend. You know, he won't get rich doing it. But he decided to do it. You know, when you're younger, you can do that type of stuff. He was probably in his 30s when he did it. And I think he said he lived in Florida prior to that. But he became friends with a couple of the insiders who were running the whole thing up there. And one of the insiders was very opened up to him quite a bit and was actually very accurate. His second insider was not, and I think his second insider was kind of a deceptive guy. But the first insider was clearly giving him inside information. He told him that the whole thing, and Pastor Lindsey Williams wrote a book about this going back, I guess, at least 40 years, The Energy Non-Crisis, about his time in Alaska. He told the people who were finding all of this untapped wealth in the United States, oil and gas in Alaska, and then it turned out elsewhere within the lower 48 states, they were finding these amazing oil finds, and the Gulf of Mexico as well. And then they were told to cap it. And this is going back into the early to mid to late 70s. They were told to cap all of these finds. And Pastor Lindsey Williams couldn't understand why they were doing this. But as the years went by, because he would say, this is like, there's really not an energy crisis. So we thought he was kind of kooky. I was listening to him back in, I guess, early 2000s, maybe 2001, I started listening to him. Now, I thought he was kind of kooky, but, I mean, obviously it did come to pass. And so he said that as the timeline compressed, World War III got closer, he said all of this wealth would be tapped. And he said the reason why they capped it was to get the United States dollar circulating around the world. And yes, it was called the petrodollar. And so we do have this reserve currency. And he says as things became tenuous, the deficits mounted and so forth, and people began losing faith in the U.S. dollar, all of this wealth would be tapped, this energy wealth, and it would be released, and it would create a resurgence in the demand for the U.S. dollar. And so hence, today, we have this great demand for the U.S. dollar. President Trump just is finishing up his trip in China, for instance, and he's worked out an agreement with Xi Jinping that China will begin buying energy from the United States. And supposedly, I think a lot of this will come from Alaska. Again, more demand for the U.S. dollar. So it is a petrodollar in reverse. And I say a lot of this goes back decades. Well, this gentleman, I want to go down further on his email and explain to him, because now we're at an inflection point here in the financial markets, and everyone's focused, and so am I. We're focused in on the Treasury yield curve. We see it spiking up against an above 5% on the 30-year. I suspect that by the time this is through, the 10-year will be above 5% again. That was that proverbial wall, that proverbial support. Remember, that's the bond prices. So bond prices were supported around that 5% yield, and they found resistance at the 4% yield. And so for the past, I guess, 5 years or so, we've been going back and forth between 4 and 5% on the 10-year. But it's never breached 5%. However, I suspect by the time this is through, we might, in fact, see a breach of 5%. Now, it goes back to quantitative easing. He mentioned here, and I just want to go through it. He says, and he's gone to a bunch of websites, he says, so here I am. I know that the system is a Ponzi. Again, it's a matter of semantics. I don't use it as a Ponzi. It's not a Ponzi scheme, and I'm going to get to this for a while. But he spoke, he's visited a bunch of websites, and he said today, he said to me in the email, that too many websites that he's visited has said this is not quantitative easing. And I submit to you it is quantitative easing. What quantitative easing is essentially is that the United States Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve, the private banking concern that lends to the United States Treasury, which then spends the money, right, floats the treasuries. The Federal Reserve notes are printed. They use those Federal Reserve notes. The federal government then uses the Federal Reserve notes to then spend and fund its deficit spending. Clearly, it's deficit spending, and it's getting larger. But he's visited websites. His concern was this is not QE. It's just adding liquidity back to the banking system. But you see, the federal, it is quantitative easing because it doesn't matter whether the purchases come from overnight treasuries or what you know, treasury bills, which are duration of anything that's a year or less, treasury notes, which is anything longer than a year to 10 years, and then treasury bills is anything longer than 10 years. So the Federal Reserve has come out and publicly stated, and they already are, you can look and you can see their assets on their Federal Reserve balance sheets have begun to creep up again. And they've estimated it's $40 billion a month. They're buying treasury bills, which are short-term bills designed to add liquidity to the banking system. But I submit to you that that was designed to allow the Federal Reserve to have the leeway to lower overnight rates. By creating demand, in this instance, $40 billion of additional demand, not, I call it non-organic demand, because it's not organic in the sense of what the markets are demanding, but you're taking $40 billion of basically money market securities, treasuries, treasury bills, off of the balance sheet, of the collective balance sheet, right, of the economy. And so what that has the ability of the Federal Reserve to do is to lower interest rates if it so chooses to do, which it had done. Because if they're not buying overnight treasuries or short-term treasuries and they decide to lower the Fed funds rate and the discount rate, for instance, what happens is that by lowering these discount rates and the federal funds rate, these overnight lending rates of the Federal Reserve, it disincentivizes institutions and potential money market investors from owning overnight paper, right? If the overnight rates are dropping, just you and me, just thinking about it, right? We have money market, we have liquidity, right? You and I do. And we decide, we're trying to figure out what to do with it. And say the money market funds are yielding 4.5%, which they were yielding over 5% back when that transitory inflation talk was being discussed. Money market funds become very attractive, right? But down here with money market funds yielding about 3.5%, right? Warren Buffett's earning about 3.75% on his money, because he says he's sticking with short-term treasuries on his balance sheet, right, for his cash. We have a headline CPI number of 3.8%. And you could say that's coming, that's transitory or not, but, you know, that's coming off a high base. It never went back to pre-COVID levels. And so now we're creeping up here, and there's one excuse after another. This time it's oil and it's war. Next time it's going to be something else. Ask yourself, are you attracted to a 3.5% money market fund? No, I have very little money left in my money market funds. I've deployed it. I've paid down some my mortgages, which some of them are as high as 7.5%. So why would I hold 3.5% money when I have borrowing at 7.5%? So I've been taking money out. What I'm saying is that you and I are not as interested in putting money in money market funds with the yields this low. So the only way that the U.S. government can find enough demand for its overnight paper is for the Federal Reserve to begin scooping up $40 billion of it a month. So this is quantitative easing. It's just not being called quantitative easing. The Federal Reserve, using the establishment media, has convinced us that quantitative easing is managing the long end of the yield curve, right? The 7s, the 10s, the 20s, and the 30s. But it doesn't matter whether it's overnight or it's long-term. And the reason being is because the United States government and the Treasury decided after COVID to finance a lot of its deficit spending in the overnight markets, right? By creating extra supply in the overnight markets, it creates relative deficits of supply in the longer end, which actually compresses the long end of the yield curve. However, the Federal Reserve is taking off and sucking up the additional or some of that additional supply in the short end. So by the Federal Reserve taking off some of the short end of that yield curve and the supply of this overnight paper, it by function is quantitative easing because it allows the federal government and the U.S. Treasury to create that vacuum on the long end. But we're noticing here that the long end of the yield curve, despite the $40 billion a month in short-term paper offtake by the Federal Reserve, it's still, now the yields are creeping up. People are realizing that this inflation is here to stay. And I'm here to tell you that, yes, it indeed is here to stay. I'm seeing it in my rents. I'm passing off 4% rent increases. That last decade, on average, my houses and my condominiums that I owned, the average rent increase was about 1.5% to 2%. I'm regularly now 3% to 4.5% rent increases, and the tenants are paying it. And so this is a shape of things to come. And so as the years creep on, the yield curve is creeping up, especially on the long end. Now, from what I can see, I think this gentleman told me he's in his early mid-30s. And I guess he's uncovered, right, what you and I have uncovered. And you know, and when we uncover what we uncover, when I first uncovered this, the wheels came off my wagon, so to speak. And I thought the sky was falling. This was 25 years ago. And I realized as I got older, and I think anyone who's long in the tooth in this study of the conspiracy, you know, the first thing we grab is the Bible. I think that's kind of like by default. We see a force that's so devilish and so overpowering in this world that we think automatically there's going to be a collapse, and we think it's the devil. And of course, it is the devil. These people who own the privately run central banks are descended from the devil's spawn. I've discussed to you going back to Cain, because the flood wasn't global. Cain, Esau, Canaanites, they were all blended together. The mixed multitudes that blended with Judah and Benjamin. These are the people that Jesus railed against. The ancestors of the privately run central banking cartel are the money changers that Jesus railed against in the temple. They go back a long way. They control the money. So the first, our gut instinct, right, is to look for a higher power. And for my fellow Caucasians, you know what we look for. We reach for the Bible and pray mighty. We get on our knees and we beg Jesus to help us, right? That's like our gut. That's our visceral instinct. And then as the years, the days, the weeks, the months, the years go by, and now the decades go by, we realize that, wow, this is a long trail that we're going to have to walk, and most likely we'll be dead by the time it reaches its termination. But when I first woke up, the instinct was to sell all my real estate and to buy gold and silver. Now, granted, I sold 3/4 of my portfolio in late 2005. It was a very auspicious time to sell, and I bought gold and silver with it. But the problem was I walked around with a backpack of gold. It was about, I don't know, it was like 20, 30 pounds or something, like 25 pounds of gold eagles. And I realized I wasn't doing anything with it. At the time, it was splendid because everything was falling apart. But we didn't have quantitative easing. So now we have quantitative easing. And yes, we may not call it quantitative easing, but it's quantitative easing. And so people say, well, how long can this continue? Well, I don't know. I suspect there might be some sort of manufactured catastrophe in the financial markets that will necessitate an outright reassumption of long-dated bonds after some sort of economic crisis. Whatever it is, it could be another COVID type of crisis. Could be an alien invasion. It could be another bioweapon. I don't know what these things are going to be. Nobody knows, but we could guess. I suspect that as bond yields begin to creep up, things become very tenuous, inflation becomes out of control, they'll manufacture something that would allow the timeline to persist for however much longer they want, and will allow the governments to spend and continue this timeline to the, not collapse, but the transformation of our economy. And that's the important thing. It's not a collapse. It's a transformation. And so owning gold and silver, I always recommend gold. Silver is great. I get it. And people have a proclivity because they can own hand truck full of silver. But the volatility of silver is so extreme, and there is an inherent conflict here. If you think that the economy is going to collapse, silver is probably not wise to own, because silver is, I'd guess about 90% of silver is because of industrial offtake, and jewelry as well. So a big chunk of silver's demand is what I would be considering elastic, and that's based on the economy. So if one thinks the economy is going to collapse, I would not want to be owning silver. However, I've noticed that over the last bunch of crises, whether it be the great financial crisis of 2008, COVID, the other little ins and outs, gold has tended to hold up better and be more predictable. And so I always recommend gold. I understand people, especially the small people, the small investors, they shy away from gold because they think gold is so overpriced. But gold is priced based on the amount of reserves that these nation states and these large institutions have. So you and I buying gold eagles have no influence on the price whatsoever. It's priced at whatever money supplies and whatever is out there in terms of the money supplies around the world, and how much gold is basically at the vaults of these private central banks, at the Federal Reserve down in Maiden Lane or wherever it is. And so it could go up multiples, and that's where the pricing is done. Whereas silver is a big chunk of it is done off of the industrial offtake. And so I like the price of gold, though you seem like you get a lot less gold. However, here's a big thing that's so important to understand, is that once you get your physical silver, once you get your physical gold, you might feel safer, but the money's outside the system. You can't leverage it. You can't use it to buy other things. It's basically the final outcome of your income, which is, in the past, I've mentioned that if you like gold, you like silver, accumulate it with your income. So if you own a portfolio of rental properties, take 20% of your rental income and devote it to gold purchases, devote it to silver purchases. I would not take my seed corn that I could otherwise use to buy income generating assets and then buy gold with that or buy silver with that, because it's kind of shutting yourself out. And then you have to ask yourself, how are you going to generate income? You know, if you're working for a living and you have a job and you're making good money, yeah, well, as long as you have income coming in. But for someone like me, I can't hold a great amount of my wealth in gold or silver because I'm deploying my money in income generating assets. And so keep in mind that as the dollar falls in value, but I'm looking here at the charts on the dollar and the USDX, it's going up in value. So yes, the dollar might be what we call collapsing, but all of the fiat currencies are collapsing. I'm looking at the dollar today. The dollar's holding up well. And the dollar's holding up well. The petrodollar is holding up well because people are freaking out. Nation state governments and corporations and foreign economies are freaking out because they're not getting enough. They don't have enough energy at the prices they need. And so they're tapping into the U.S. energy markets. Like I said, this plan goes back a long way. As the dollar began to fade because of its budget and its trade deficits, the untold wealth of the energy markets that was capped for since going back to early 1970s would be uncapped and would be unleashed onto the world. And that's why Trump is now saying China will be importing U.S. oil. Who'd ever think we'd ever see these things? But hey, look, this plan goes back a long way. So yes, owning gold and silver is great, but don't do it to the extent that you don't buy and own the income generating assets. I've always mentioned, own the income generating assets, because we don't know when this collapse may come. And here's the thing, if there is an economic crisis, if there is something like COVID, the United States Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank can come back and provide more funding and lower that yield curve. And just when we think that it can't continue, it can continue. And here's something else he brought up, and this is the final thing I want to mention. This is called Ferguson's Law. And it's kind of like this fast and loose thing that when interest outlays begin to become greater than the military outlays of a government. In this case, when the interest outlays now are about $1.5 trillion a year in the United States, Treasury is laying out that much on a run rate here for its Treasury holdings and the interest payments. When that becomes greater than the amount of money that the federal government is spending on its defense, then the empire begins to fall, right? And that's called Ferguson's Law. Now, here's something. It goes back a long way. It goes back to these Israelite economies, back to the 1500s and before. Now, here's the thing about the laws of the mandates of the Federal Reserve. In order to get the Federal Reserve passed, to make it look like it was an arm's length institution that it was serving at the behest of the federal government, whenever the Federal Reserve earned more money on its portfolio of securities than its operating costs and its capital losses of that underlying portfolio, its interest income, essentially, its profit, its net profit was remitted back to the U.S. Treasury. So what I'm trying to get at here is something very important to understand. Just as the United States economy has been closed off, has basically been walled off from the rest of the world with regards to energy, the United States is now a net exporter of energy to the rest of the world. So it's largely walled off, and I've told you that OPEC is a dead, visceral organ that doesn't exist anymore. OPEC's purpose, which was to create the petrodollar, no longer serves a function. And that's why we're seeing, I think the United Arab Emirates left OPEC formally. I think that's what it is. But you see it falling apart. It's fraying. And that's because OPEC is no longer being used. So like I said, the United States economy is now walled off from the rest of the world with regards to the energy market, which is probably at least half the battle right there. I want to mention something that is potential to be important here. And it refutes Ferguson's Law to some extent. I'm not telling you it's going to be a permanent feature, But because the Federal Reserve is required to remit the interest income it earns above and beyond its expenses and capital losses back to the U.S. Treasury, theoretically, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury can form a closed loop. Say, for instance, the United States Federal Reserve accumulates 50% of the entire treasuries that are outstanding. It accumulates them and puts them onto the balance sheet. Well, what does that mean? That means that 50% of the interest income the United States Treasury is laying out is going to the Federal Reserve. And under law, the United States Federal Reserve is required to remit that money back to the U.S. Treasury. So it becomes a closed loop, theoretically. So it can prolong this. I don't know how many things can be conjured up. Just when we think that things are falling apart, they introduce something that can refute that and can extend the timeline. And in so doing, the income-generating asset owners will continue to benefit. So keep all this in mind. It's a very fluid situation, but we understand that this is decades in the making. And this plan goes back a long, long way. The formulators of the Federal Reserve over 100 years ago, 112, 113 years ago, knew that eventually that the federal government would collapse under debt, right? And so they had ways of extending it. And it's not a collapse. It's not a catastrophe. And it's not a Ponzi scheme. Another important item to keep in mind. This is not a Ponzi scheme. It is a well-crafted out transfer of wealth. And that's important to understand. It is a process of transferring the wealth into tighter hands. And in this case, it's the synagogue of Satan banking cartel. We see the wealth being consolidated. And by function, that's just the way it's supposed to be. Those who own the assets, and the more assets we own, the more income-generating assets that we own, the wealthier we become just by function. And that's the way it's supposed to be. So it's not a Ponzi scheme, because Ponzi schemes collapse and, just a couple of people walk away and everybody's... No, it's a transfer of wealth. And this transfer of wealth motivates people to continually develop new technologies. And yeah, it's tracking and tracing. And welcome to our modern slavery. Slavery was never done away with. We can rejoice that, the blacks no longer are under servitude. But they're still actually, I know black tenants, they're under a mental servitude that's god-awful, where they just blame everybody. And they're actually, in a lot of respects, they're even worse off, because they're making their money, and then they're cast down with the sodomites to try to pay for their rent and food and everything else. In a lot of respects, a slave was probably treated better and had everything done for him. He worked, and then he had his medical care. He had his roof over his head. He had all the food that he wanted. He had his clothing. He had everything. He was taken care of. He was a status symbol. So in a lot of regards, the blacks are worse off now than they were there before the Civil War. But hey, we're all slaves now. All right, that's about it. I just wanted to show you this email. And even a graduate business degree holder still comes to the same conclusions that we come to, has the same observations. Now, he can succeed in this world. He can do very well. And I think a lot of the people who are the billionaires of this world come to the conclusions that you and I have come to. However, they find it so profitable, as Lord Rothschild said back, right? Those who finally uncover this massive theft, I'm paraphrasing, they are either too stupid to understand it, or they're making too much profit to go against it. And so, hey, there's nothing you and I could do to change this. Just warn others, tell people how to survive. And that's what I have on my blog. This is how we survive. All right, until next time, peace, God bless, Godspeed. Thomas Stone out.